Mini episode 657 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to mini episode 657 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We are joined on the phone lines today by a good friend of the show, someone who has been a repeat contributor over a period of time, somebody who we have enjoyed covering politics with over a period of time. This is our second cycle of covering presidential politics with him, our third cycle overall in the history of the program, of course, dating back to 2007 in terms of covering presidential politics. I speak, of course, of Colin Delaney of ePolitics.com. It's always an interesting thing when he and I are on the show together, he being a gentleman of the left, myself being someone of the paleo right, and yet we always manage to have what I know he and I take pride in, conversations that deliver a lot more light than heat, as they say. Although, again, I like to phrase some questions in the form of a friendly trolling question just to get a good laugh, but that's just my sense of humor at work. I'm sure we'll be touching on that a lot as we go on today because there's a lot to laugh about and perhaps cry about in this presidential cycle. We'll be getting to all that and everything in between with good friend of the program, Colin Delaney of ePolitics. Colin, welcome to the program here today. How are you, my man?
I'm doing great. You know, all this goodwill is so, it's just so thick in the air, I almost want to start with a Yo Mama joke just to kind of, you know, loosen us up a little bit. Jeez, man.
Oh, I'm sure. We'll have an opportunity to do that as we go along through the course of this today. And, you know, I will preface by saying, too, that I'm not even going to try to shoehorn too much in there for my guy, Rand Paul, at this point in time, as I realize that, unfortunately, due to the way I think events have evolved in this cycle, some of the foreign crises, he has unfortunately and unfairly been on the periphery of this thing. I am very, very happy that he is going to be in the CNN debate that will be taking place tomorrow as we are taping this. And, again, he made it in by the skin of his teeth and by doing a little bit of politicking there. But I tell you what, and again, you are an expert on all things digital with politics, and you know what to look for as far as having your ear to the ground. I will tell you this, as somebody who has a million different Rand Paul things showing up on my Facebook wall, I'm in more groups than I could tell you. There's a lot of things happening on the ground with the college kids in Iowa and to a certain extent New Hampshire, and I get the sense that there's a lot more going on than what the polls are telling us there. So mm-hmm. I want you to try to discern for us, not just for him, but in general. When you see a lot of this stuff on there that some people would dismiss perhaps as noise, how much of it do you make out of it when you see a candidate that has a very, very active social presence and is trying to target non-traditional markets?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I don't look so much in terms of the activity in terms of how often are they posting, how many followers they have. What I'm interested in is how much engagement are they getting? Are people liking their comments? More importantly, are they sharing it? Are they commenting on it? Because, you know, the candidates are generally, well, okay, first off, we have to distinguish between what's happening on the campaign's public Facebook page and then all of the targeted advertising they're doing. And we don't get to see the targeted advertising. So I just want to preface by saying I'm only talking about what's happening organically on their page. And Rand Paul is consistently doing very well. You know, every Monday or every Friday, rather, I put out a list of the overperforming presidential campaign Facebook posts, i.e. the ones that are doing unusually well in terms of numbers relative to the size of their audience. Rand Paul has consistently been on the list since we started doing it earlier, I think over the summer. This last time, I believe he had the top two slots. So his content is resonating with his supporters. The problem is that broader chunk of the Republican electorate. I get the sense. And you mentioned college campuses. You know, when I was an undergrad, actually I was just chatting with him on Facebook the other day. You know, one of my libertarian friends in college. I had quite a few libertarian friends in college, even though Rice, where I went, was a relatively liberal school. So I think colleges are where one would expect there to be libertarian activism. I think it goes along in some ways with the college idealism.
The bigger question
is, why hasn't he resonated with a bigger chunk of the Republican electorate? Had it been a smaller field, would that have helped, do you think?
It's a very good question. I think I'm going to circle back again to, I think that the atmosphere has been kind of inhospitable for it in terms of the fortunes started to kind of turn around as early as the summer of 2014, when ISIS was on the march in the Middle East, and there became a sense, again, I think extraordinarily unfairly, that he's peddling a brand of isolationism that doesn't have an answer for these things, when in fact he is somebody that had put forth a resolution of war against ISIS in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, and said, if you're going to do it the right way, do it the constitutional way. But I think with the recent setbacks against ISIS here, the Paris attacks, now San Bernardino, I think there's the consensus out there, and I'm not ready to be defeatist enough to buy into it yet, is that he's a candidate who is out of step with this moment in America. And I think tomorrow night's debate is going to have a lot to say about it. I'll tell you what, you know that a neocon like Hugh Hewitt is going to be trying to bait him and throw a hardball at his head. I just hope he can turn around in the batter's box, so to speak, and really crank that sucker when it's coming. And that moment's going to tell a lot.
Okay, so here's another thing that I've been hearing recently, and I've been wondering about it myself. You don't see Ron Paul out there very much for his son. And I've read a couple of things lately that suggest that Ron Paul is weirdly not as supportive of his son's political career as we might expect. I mean, he was running gold bug ads, basically, you know, these things telling you that there's a financial crisis happening tomorrow and you need to buy gold. He was running those TV ads on cable back in August, September, when, you know, if there's any Paul messaging out there, that ought to be about the son. You know, dad ought to step back and not make money for a second, you know? So I wonder if the father has not mobilized his own base to the extent that he could have.
And this is an interesting – you raise an interesting point about that. And here's the thing, and I speak as somebody that appears to be at this point maybe a small minority of the Rand Paul electorate, in that I was never really a Ron Paul guy. I was sympathetic to a lot of his arguments. But I think, again, I think he's a real isolationist. I think that he is nutty on this kind of stuff. I like where Rand's at, because the hard Paul, Ron Paul types that think that he's a sellout, I think Rand Paul has done the natural evolution of the movement. He's brought it into the mainstream, so to speak. And, I mean, I like the Ron Paul stuff with the edge of sanded off. I will tell you, among the hardcore Ron Paul people, that is a minority opinion. And what does Ron Paul himself think? I mean, it's not exactly a repudiation of where he stands, but the very effort to try to bring this into the mainstream here and make it a more broadly appealing coalition, it's at odds with everything he tried to do. He was a purist on a lot of this stuff, and that's why I think he was, quite frankly, kooky on a lot of things, where I like the song. But that's not how a lot of his supporters see it.
Well, and like I was talking to a good friend of mine here in town who's a libertarian a few weeks ago about Rand, and he can't support him because of the he wants to ban abortion. And to my friend, that is the opposite of a libertarian position.
Well, that's what's interesting, see, because you and I have been having this conversation throughout your appearances on the show. I think Rand Paul, although he doesn't identify as such, is a paleocon like myself. To an extent, paleocons are social conservative libertarians, because Ron Paul himself, by the way, was pro-life. So it's not the first time there that was the case. So it's an interesting kind of a thing. And I think that, again, there are a lot of libertarians out there, and again, you know, that guy, I mean, I can see where he's coming from if that's an issue that he's going to vote on. But a lot of the ones that are just doing the kind of picky, kind of purist kind of a thing, The libertarians that think Rand Paul is not good enough on, say, the economic issues or foreign policy or whatever, my question to those bozos is, when are you ever going to get somebody who can get elected president who's going to be more for you than he is on those issues? Those people are, aside from your friend who's voting on something else, those people are not even remotely living in the real world. This is as close to a libertarian as we're ever going to see.
Certainly in the current political environment.
Yes. I think that's definitely the case, and again, I don't want to be self-indulgent by spending too much time on my guy, given where he is in the polls here. But you know, it's an interesting sort of subtext. He has had a lot of his support, quite frankly, vacuumed up by Ted Cruz, who is trying to be
a lot of things. We would go on a cruise after this.
a lot. He's trying to be a lot of things to a lot of people, quite frankly, and. Although Ted Cruz, where I give him some credit, although I think it's completely opportunistic, is that he's the only other one, aside from Rand Paul, that has dared to mention the name neocon in this race, as he has done it to draw a point of comparison to Rubio. It's funny that after the recent debates, people were thinking that Rubio and Cruz together were going to be coming towards the fore. Instead, it has been Cruz who has been taking advantage of the inevitable fall of Ben Carson. We've been seeing the flavor of the month like this, like the fall of 2012, except it's been as an alternative to Donald Trump as opposed to the leader in the race as it was in 2012. But my question to you about Cruz and looking at this now, or actually rather, let me first ask you one about Rubio. I get the sense, you know, you look at the Maginot line that France always had here, that'll keep the Nazis out. I think that's been Rubio's whole kind of campaign thing here. You know, with proper, you know, backing from the media, the conservative media, and everything like that, and enough money, we're going to take down everybody. I look at this guy, his organization in the states out there, he can't name an early state where he's going to be real strong in. I mean, Marco Rubio, to me, seems like a paper tiger, and I think that's why Cruz has blown past it. What say you?
Well, I think you're bringing up some great points. I'll tell you, when I started watching Cruz closely, well, two things. One, when he launched his campaign, he got a really big spike of attention. Now, he, at the time, some of the analysis, I'm talking about, like, basically, you know, website traffic, social media mentions, the kind of things that build your small donor list, right? I wondered if it was just because he was the first one out the gate on the Republican side. That was what a good chunk of the analysis was. But back in, like, September – oh, you know what it was? It was after the it was in early October, after the FEC filings in September.
Okay.
You saw that Cruz was bringing in a really surprisingly large percentage of small donors. He and Carson were both doing it. Both of them had powerful small donor bases, as opposed to a Bush, for instance.
Right.
And you know, if small donors have become really important in American politics because they don't max out, right? Now, super PAC's a different world, but if you're giving to a candidate, you can't give more than a certain $27.50 a year, something like that. So if someone's giving you $50, they're giving you $50 to get it again, you can hit them up constantly. And that was huge for Obama in the primaries in 2008. So Ted Cruz is building a small donor base. Now we hear that he is building up a grassroots operation, not just in the first, like, four states, but beyond. And then today the Post came out with a story about their use of political data, which may be a little overblown. We'll see. But they're at least doing the mechanics of the kind of campaign that put Obama in the White House. Now, you know, politics is politics, issues are different issues, but he has, you know, his people know the mechanics of modern political excellence, and that's something to keep an eye on.
It really, really is. And I have to ask you about this, too, because it's been really, really interesting in the last week watching him and Trump circling one another, because these are by far the two candidates who are the most at odds with the establishment. My guy, I think, to an extent, the way that he co-opted Mitch McConnell, I think, you know, he's somebody that they would take over these two guys. But these are the two guys in the picture right now. They hate Trump for obvious reasons. They hate Cruz because he's been a pain in their ass. He has insulted them publicly, privately, et cetera, through the course of time here. What's been interesting in the last week is Trump has tried to make the point that Cruz is too poisonous personally to be able to succeed in Washington. Cruz made the point behind closed doors that Trump is a guy that, you know, he doesn't have the temperament to be president. So it's interesting that, like, both of them are trying to go in the other direction to try to look a little bit more mainstream as opposed to the other guy, when they're the two ones out there that the establishment hates the most. So I guess my question for you would be, who do you think, you know, if you strapped lie detectors to Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and everybody else, what could they live with more, nominee Donald Trump or nominee Ted Cruz?
Oh, God, nominee Ted Cruz in a quarter of a second. They may loathe the man, but he's not Donald Trump. Donald Trump makes America the laugh. He makes America the laughing stock of the world. I was just over at a thing. I was doing a couple of sessions at a fundraising conference in Eastern Europe. So talking with a lot of people around from Eastern Europe. This is back in like September, October. I got question after question about Trump, and I just had to keep telling people, because they just see, you know, the top line numbers over there. I'm like, he's getting support from a third of the Republican electorate, right, in the polls. That's like 14% of the country. And 14 or 15% of everywhere is a little crazy. So,
right.
You know, Trump is going to have a base of people who, because there are people out there that, I mean, a lot of people who see him saying things that they say, you know, everyone's been saying this, he's the only one who'll say it in public, or everyone's been thinking this, he's the only one who'll say it in public. But often it's things that you don't say in public because they're rude, racist, or bigoted, you know. So, but there is that chunk that is going to stay with him. But it is possible that Trump will not win a single primary. It is possible. I doubt it. I bet he'll win a few. But it's certainly possible that he wins none, that the anyone but Trump vote is more powerful than the Trump vote.
That may very well be the case. But in terms of looking at it now, I have to tell you again, and I've had some of my friends kind of ragging on me, you know, like the kind of people who care about the Republican Party as opposed to myself, who, you know, in terms of, you know, we talk about the free market and creative destruction. To me, if Donald Trump brings it down permanently, hey, give me whatever springs up in its place. I don't care about the Republican Party. Well, my friends who do say to me, why doesn't your guy get out of the race? He's got no chance. I sit here in December and I say, how are any of us that damn smart right now? Donald Trump should have killed himself 20 times over here at this point in the race. I think anybody should be very, very, very skeptical in terms of, you know, believing anything like that, any kind of pronouncement that, you know, I mean, it's some of these guys obviously are dead. Mike Huckabee, Lindsey Graham, they were never serious to begin with. But in terms of looking at this race, when Donald Trump has defied the laws of political gravity so many times in the last 4 months alone, how can any of us believe anything has 100% certitude? I don't think that the lessons of the past apply here. Do you?
Oh, of course. Well, let's just say the lessons of the past don't apply as mechanistically as people sometimes try to apply them, right?
Okay,
and you can certainly learn from the past.
Sure.
You know, unfortunately to me, the best analogies to Hitler, I mean, I'm sorry, to Trump, see how that came out? The best analogies to Trump are a lot of the right-wing nationalist movies of the 1920s and populist movements here in the States. Huey Long down in Louisiana would happily have set himself up as a dictator of some kind. So, you know, I look back to that. There is a legitimate – there are millions, tens of millions of people in this country who feel disconnected from the ways the culture is evolving, right?
Yep.
Everything from the TV programs to the language to the hip-hop blaring out of, ironically, some redneck kid's pickup truck. Right. But no, seriously, like my parents hear thud, thud, thud going by. It doesn't occur to them that three quarters of the time it's a redneck guy. Right.
Because
he's kid. He loves with hip hop. But where was I going with this?
Someplace interesting.
Oh, I totally lost the train of thought there. I went so far down the thing. Oh, there's a group of, you know, there are tens of millions of people who feels like disconnected from where the country's going. And many of them are honestly fearful. And I think Trump has tapped into that. Cruz uses a lot of the same kind of language. I mean, he's not as blunt about, say, you know, immigrants or, you know, Mexicans or rapists, that kind of thing. But he does say a lot of things that speak to those same kinds of fears. So I think that a chunk of the Trump vote would switch to someone like Cruz. A piece of the Trump vote is what John Stewart called the asshole vote, right? It's everybody in the country, regardless of politics, you know, has kind of a jerk about things. They like Trump. What was I going to say? So I think that in a lot of liberals dismiss these people, but, you know, this is a real and legitimate concern of theirs, and it's sad. It's unfortunate. The problem is that it's ripe territory for demagoguery, right? And Trump is nothing if not, you know, trying to ride a wave of demagoguery. I think it was John Dickerson and Slate compared him to Mussolini. You know, Mussolini didn't run around shooting people, but, you know, he shut down political dissent very happily. But again, he was appealing to the same sort of, like, a lot of imagery, a lot of projection of strength. If you feel like the world is changing around you, those sorts of things are very reassuring. And strongmen throughout history have used that kind of language to mobilize masses of people. I think Trump's dangerous. You know, I really do.
I've heard a lot of people make those comparisons, and I kind of see a little bit of that myself, too. It's one of these things where, again, there are long-term ramifications to getting stuff wrong, and the Republican Party, for all of their sins of the last 15 years, again, their hands are not clean. They are largely responsible for the rise of Donald Trump. Now, what I'd like to ask you is this, though, because if you look at this, you look at the economic numbers right now, and again, now I've said this to you, and this is a criticism I make of administrations of both parties. I think that generally speaking, the jobs numbers are hogwash because they don't include the people who've been pushed off the rolls, and the labor participation numbers are not super rosy at the moment. But having said that, the unemployment number on paper, that one number looks good right now. So. Yeah. Granted, there's the issue of ISIS, but even before the recent, or even after the recent crises that we've had with Paris, with San Bernardino, it's not necessarily the number one topic of conversation every day in this country. There's nothing on paper that points to why Trump would be thriving in this climate. I have a theory, and I will tell you, it was endorsed on the show recently by Bob Barker, of all people, when he was complaining about the way things are today. So how's that for eclectic? My theory is
I like it.
Okay, I think it's 14 years in the making. This country rolled from 9/11 into the Iraq War, into the economic downturn. We haven't had, in my estimation, a good day since September 10th, 2001. And I think this is people going, when the hell are we going to be America again? We have been knocked on our ass. We can't get up. If the economy's okay, then we're at war. If we're at war, you know, then vice versa. You know, we can't get our S together the way that we once did. And I think people feel it slipping away. I think he's playing on 14 years of fatigue. What do you think?
I think that is a piece of what I was talking about, right?
Okay.
You're talking about white working class and also, like, middle class. You think of, like a plumber, somebody who's got some money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's worried about the way things are changing. And, you know, if you live in a small town somewhere, it's probably gone to hell, right? There are no jobs anymore in a lot of small towns. I'm from one, and my mom's from another. We were just in both of them. And, the county has 6 prisons where I grew up. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any jobs around. So there are legitimate economic changes that are happening. We also know that wages simply have not gone up for the vast majority of Americans. We are a much wealthier people in many ways, right? Asset prices have gone up. Anybody who owned a house, you know, unless you're in Detroit, probably did fairly well as long as you didn't buy into a bubble, right? But but wages aren't really going up. And people sense that they're falling behind. And there are absolute numbers out there that like income mobility is, you know, if you're born within, you know, a certain income range, your children are much less likely than they were 30 or 40 years ago to rise out of that. So, you know, that's a real problem that I would love to hear one of the Republican candidates address with anything other than tax cuts that, when analyzed, overwhelmingly go to the top 0.1% of Americans. You know, it's in from a liberal point of view, you know, there's a book, What's the Matter with Kansas? This is sort of his hypothesis, that the Republican Party has been using moral issues like gay marriage. 2004, Karl Rove got anti-gay marriage amendments on state ballots in places like Ohio to help boost the evangelical vote. The Republicans have been using moral issues to turn out people who are in turn voting against their own real economic interests. I mean, tax cuts, Jeb Bush's tax cut program would add something like $10 trillion to the deficit, and almost all the benefits go to people who are already in the top 1%.
Well, I mean, by the same token, and I agree that you should be pushing for things to be, revenue neutral, particularly in this climate with the spiraling federal debt and everything we've seen in the last 15 years here. But it is always, in my estimation, kind of a fine line here because, again, in terms of where does job growth come from? Who are the job creators? And as long as you have it right as it is right now with the tax code, where small businesses are basically classified, most of them, under the top individual income bracket, we've got a system right now where if you're trying to goose growth, there's also a question of where does it come from? We're not in Bernie Sanders' beloved USSR yet at this point, you know, to where the government's creating these things. So in my isn't that kind of a dance that we all run into in terms of, well, if you're going to create job growth, if you're going to go for that, you know, what are the things you do to kind of stoke it?
Sure, absolutely. The great thing is that we do have history to look at over the last 30 years. And over the last 30 years, you look at Bill Clinton's tax increases, which were supposed to throw the economy into a deep depression, which were followed by a massive boom, which unfortunately ended with the dot-com bubble, right? But the Clinton boomlet was already underway before the internet was really any kind of a business, before anybody was making money off of it. Bush comes in, proposes tax cuts that will boost the economy in theory. Now, 9/11 does happen, right? That happens, and that's an external shock to the system. A recession happened after that, and in the 7 years after that recession, under the Bush tax code regime, which was supposed to boost the economy, we grew far fewer jobs than under an equivalent period under either Clinton or Obama. We have been running experiments in this. Cutting wealthy people's taxes demonstrably does not improve the economy.
Well,
all they do is buy bigger apartments in New York.
Sure. I mean, the 2001 and 2008 tax cuts, though, and I remember getting mine, which was, you know, as nice a chunk as I think just about anybody got out of it. Those were Keynesian ones. Those weren't really targeted. Those were like, let's put some money back in people's hands regardless. Those weren't really job creation tax cuts, though. So those, and I remember saying at the time, I was like, this is great getting this money back. I'm not under any illusions this is doing anything for the economy, but this is great getting my money back. So
that's how I saw
it both times.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got $600. Actually, that was the best money that could have been spent because it went into the hands of people who turned around and spent that money right away. For instance, actually, if you want to boost the economy, one of the least expensive ways to do it is to fund art programs, because for every $30,000 or $35,000 you spend on art programs, you create a job, where like for every, I think it's like $800,000 or $900,000 of highway spending creates a job. Because it's capital intensive. But that money went straight into people's hands, most of whom spent it right away. If a wealthy person gets an extra $10 million, almost always that goes into investment, which is these days means it's going into financial speculation, right? When we're investing in this country these days, we're investing in what are functionally bets in you know, a stock market or an asset market. People aren't investing enough in literal physical things like roads, bridges, you know, high-speed internet access to places that don't have it, modern energy infrastructure, a natural gas pipeline system that leaks half of the methane in it into the atmosphere, right? If you want to save some money, let's put some money into some physical things. And you talked about the deficit. Well, right now, interest rates are so low that the interest on a 30-year bond is basically below inflation. So
that's right.
We can borrow for free. It's actually saving money. And if you're investing in things like roads and bridges and natural gas pipelines, then you're creating the infrastructure for future growth. But you, if you give that money to a venture capitalist, they're not going to put it into roads and bridges. They're going to put it into something much more speculative, and very often something whose benefit is purely financial. The banks don't loan money to businesses anymore. It's a tiny fraction of their business. Most of their business is flipping assets.
That's true. There is some money. Well, there is, again. You know, when you look at the small businesses that are in the top income bracket, I mean, there is some of that action going on there as well. But in terms of the X's and O's of the race, one more thing to ask you about the Republican side, and then necessarily we're going to give short shrift to the Democratic side because I think things have really kind of shaken out there in the permanent form. On the Republican side, this talk about, in my hometown of Cleveland, possibly a brokered convention next year, I'd like you to rate that. And by the way, don't think the party leaders wouldn't be loving that for their chance to kind of get Trump or Cruz out of the way here. But so I think it's not just innocent kind of like, well, let's see what happens if it comes to that. I think there's going to be a lot of trying to throw roadblocks if there's a guy that they don't like who gets out in front there, as may be the case. But I'd like you to rate the prospects here of Donald Trump getting the nomination, Ted Cruz getting the nomination, or a brokered convention that goes to somebody else. Well, what would you say is 1, 2, 3 in the orders of probability?
That's a good question.
Tough one.
I would say.
Tough one.
Yeah. No, I go with my gut.
Okay.
Trump doesn't ever get beyond his core base. I don't think he wins. I don't think it's certainly possible. My God, anything's possible. But when we come to the point that real human beings are voting and not just polls, my suspicion is he doesn't get much above his little base. And early in the primaries, I believe up until after March maybe, the first few primaries are proportional. Only the later ones
right.
are winner take all.
Yeah, that's right.
So if some reasonable alternative to Trump builds up in those first few primaries, they may well knock out all the also-rans and have it be a one-on-one or a one-on-one with a couple of hangers-on. You know what I mean? A Rick Santorum who's just not going to give up.
Right.
In that case, I think it's Cruz right now is who it would look like it would be. It's certainly possibly it's going to be Rubio. I do think I do agree with your kind of not too strong opinion of Rubio's power. You know, paper tiger
right.
may well be true. I might watch him in four years or eight years though. But we'll see. We'll see. But right now, I like Cruz in the sense of the technical campaign that he's building. And I think he can capture a significant number of voters away from Trump and Carson. But we'll see. But then, so I would put Cruz first, brokered convention second, and then an outright Trump victory as third, and to me, a real long shot.
I kind of agree, although I think 2 and 3 are maybe a closer call than you would say, but somebody puts a gun to my head, I would agree with the order of finish. I think Trump has more of a chance of winning this than you do, but yeah, he probably comes in, I'd say, narrowly behind a brokered convention scenario, which, again, should be fascinating to see materializing right here in my hometown next year.
Right.
On the Democratic side, I've been kind of struck by recently this notion that we seem to, because it's always been very, very interesting to me, and it's not, it's certainly not an incumbent scenario with Hillary Clinton running. I thought it was closer to being in an incumbent situation in 2008 than I do this time, because again, as you know, first lady of a former president, you don't get much stronger of a shot than that. But it's, it looks to me like it's kind of settling into a 2000 dynamic right now. Her in the spot of Al Gore. Sanders seems to have receded to sort of the Bill Bradley type scenario right now. Martin O'Malley completely irrelevant unless Hillary implodes completely. But
Do you get the sense that after all the early momentum with Sanders that it has sort of settled back into that as Hillary didn't die in the first couple of debates there and seems to have held everything off for now?
Yeah, I'll tell you, man. The thing with candidates like Bernie Sanders and Paul Tsonga and Bill Bradley, there just aren't enough upper-income white voters in the Democratic Party to elect them. You know, what we would have called the Volvo set 20 years ago, they love people like Bernie Sanders. But the Democratic coalition is really broad, and none of those guys have ever been able to, and I'll note have ever been able to break out of that, you know, sort of that voter ghetto. The race for Veep is interesting, and I think it heavily depends on who the Republican nominee is. If the Republican nominee is Rubio, the BS chatter among us kids is it'd be one of the Castro brothers from
Texas. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those guys have a lot of future ahead of them. You know what I mean? So there's no need to rush. And there's no way in hell that a Democrat wins Texas anytime in the next, you know, dozen years at least.
You make that move to help demographically, not for a state.
Oh yeah, well that's the thing. Okay, so the next, you know, if it's Cruz, for instance, I think you're going to see, like I've heard Tim Kaine tossed around. Definitely, he's a little bit older white guy. He'd be reassuring to some, sort of centrist voters, older white voters. And I think he would, he also helps you in Virginia. And, you know, he seems like a genuinely nice, soft-spoken guy. I think he'll kind of help Hillary, smooth some of her rough edges.
So in other words, Tim Kaine would sort of be cosplaying as Ed Muskie in this electoral cycle. Is that what you're saying?
Except, you know, I only know Ed Muskie through Hunter Thompson's descriptions of him, so I don't come off with a favorable opinion of Muskie. So I got a question for you, because you know the Republican electorate much better than I. If it goes to a brokered convention and they knock out a Trump or a Carson, the establishment does, what do those voters do? What do his voters do?
Well, here's the thing. If it's to put somebody else in there, like Marco Rubio does not have any kind of strong connection with the base right now. That's why he is where he is in the polls. I think that immigration really kind of took the steam out of him. He is regarded as suspect in many quarters. The effort would be to try to prop up somebody like him. I've even heard Mitt Romney's name getting floated by some people if it comes to that kind of a deal. The base will revolt. I think it's a prescription for losing another election. And again, because everybody's going to take it as these a-holes are trying to ramrod their candidate on us. And that's the way it's going to go. I have a question for you as well about the Democratic side of things. And I'm going to preface this by saying I still want to do something I teased out earlier on the show here. Maybe after the nominees are settled, I'd like to do a two-part thing with you, the state of the left and the state of the right in 2016, and kind of get a broader overview of the way that things are at. I think you and I could really sink our teeth into that, you know, do one on each of those two. But as far as the Democratic side of things, we talked about Bernie Sanders. This is a burning question to me because – from your point of view, you would say empathy. From my point of view, I would say white guilt. But to a guy like Bernie Sanders, as far as connecting with the Black Lives Matter crew, how could that guy be any further on the left on any issue you could ever name than him? It strikes me as hilarious that guys like him cannot connect with the Black activists. I mean, is it just a cultural thing, or what the hell is it?
Well, okay, so I was in the room at Netroots Nation when the activists took the stage, and Bernie even had time to prepare, and he delivered one of the most tone-deaf responses I've ever heard. This was not a crew that, you know, has a whole lot, you know, 25-year-old activists who are people of color who feel marginalized in this country, like, you know, many older white voters too, ironically enough. But they didn't have anything in common with a grumpy old Jewish grandfather from Brooklyn, you know? He's a different generation, a different cultural style, and you know, the thing is that Black Lives Matter isn't really based. I've had a chance to talk with some folks that have been really embedded in it lately or deeply involved in it. And it is less about a specific set of policy provisions than it is an idea that there are things in this country that we have not been paying attention to that are morally wrong, and we need to pay attention to them, right? You know, Hillary Clinton had her legendary run-in where she said, if you don't turn this into policy, what does it matter? You know, then you're not going to accomplish anything. And, you know, I definitely see where she's coming from. But I think that she is that the Black Lives Matter movement is aimed at something much broader than changing policy. They're trying to change the whole way American culture approaches race, and we'll see what happens. So yeah, they're not invested in the Democratic Party. They don't give a flip about Bernie Sanders. You know, they care about changing the way America thinks. And if picking a fight with Bernie Sanders helps, then it may well advance their agenda. That makes sense?
That makes sense to me on at least a minimal level. But again, my confusion comes from I'm an issues guy, okay? My whole thing is like I'm with Rand Paul because issues. He checks off more of my boxes than anybody else. Bernie Sanders checks off all the boxes I would think on policy these people want. That's where my confusion comes in. You did a good job of explaining it. If you're saying it's about things other than that, then okay. All I can say is, again, you know, as somebody on the other side of the aisle, makes me kind of glad that people aren't bonding over things that maybe, you know, shouldn't be an obstacle.
Well, I mean, yeah. There is, I think, at the far right and the far left, that natural tendency to splinter into fragments. I mean, I know there were cities where there were more than one Tea Party group that weren't talking to each other. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, there's a great scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian where they're, you know, having a secret cell meeting in an outdoor space, and the People's Front for the Liberation of Judea is over here. The Judean People's Liberation Front is over there. The Front for the Liberation of Judea is across the way. That kind of happens. It's bad when it does because it wastes a lot of, you know, energy either way. But I think it is the reason that this doesn't seem logical to you is that this group doesn't have a policy agenda. They have an ideological, in a sense. They're basically saying that we're ignoring some things that are a betrayal of American democracy.
Okay. All right. I mean, again, you, I think, did a very, very good job of explaining it because I don't, you know, I'm probably in a minority in today's America. I feel like it on Facebook anyways, as far as being an issues guy. Certainly, I'm not surrounded by issues guys on Facebook, including my own friends. But for anybody that is, I think it's a puzzling thing. You did a great job of explaining it, as is always the case. We'll see what happens with these debates, and look forward to catching up with you down the road, my friend, possibly before we even have the two nominees settled again, but certainly, if not before then, at the point that they are. Thank you. Best wishes to you and ePolitics in 2016. Continued growth, my friend. You're doing a great job over there.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks for having me on long enough for us to have a real conversation. You know, we've been talking for over 40 minutes, and there are just not a whole lot of places in the world where you get that kind of opportunity.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the kind words that you've always given to it, including on your own site in the past. That makes me feel really good. It makes me feel really good to be able to have these conversations with you. We'll keep breaking it down. We'll keep amazing the people with it in 2016. Thank you so much, Colin.
Appreciate it, man. Talk to you soon.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Paper Mate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.